Okay, so just when you thought that you're talking about reality, I'm gonna switch back to simulations, but only for a little while, and I'm gonna repeat some of the stuff that were already discussed this morning by Phil, Oscar, Andre, and others. But I'm gonna also show a bunch of new results, mostly based on work of Sasha Murato, sitting here in the audience. And this is the work done in this FIRE collaboration with Phil Hopkins, Claude André, Fouché Giguère, Sasha, Elliot Porter, Norm Murray, and several other people. So I'm gonna show a bunch of results from them. Again, repeating what we already discussed this morning, there is clearly a need for feedback to explain how galaxies form and to explain their masses. So what is shown on this plot is the mass function of galaxies as a function of their stellar mass in these units. And this black line shows actual observed mass function of galaxies. This also black line, but straight line, shows what would happen if you just map all of the baryons in dark matter halos into stars. And this red line shows what we actually get in simulations that do not have any galactic winds, but do have cooling physics and do have shock heating of the halo material and do have UV background. So these simple simulations that do not include any wind physics actually overshoot galaxy masses at both high mass and the low mass end compared to observations. And what is interesting to point out, something that Andre was already discussing this morning, is that it's not that they overshoot in this direction. That's not how the abundance matching works, but the differences are actually in the horizontal direction. So while the differences in masses at the high mass end are probably only factors of few, differences in masses between simulated galaxies and simulations without strong winds and the observations can be actually huge. They can be order of magnitude or even factors of 100 or 1,000 or so, because you need to match number densities in horizontal direction. So this lower part of the plot basically shows the correction factor of these simulations to reach the observations. So clearly, we need to do something with these galaxies, and some sort of mechanism needs to either expel material out of galaxies or prevent this accretion in the first place, that because that material will go into stars. And the most promising candidate we have at the low mass end seem to be star formation-driven feedback. At the high mass end, it might be connected to agent physics, but unfortunately, I will not talk about it in this talk. I will focus on the low mass end and see if the star formation-driven feedback can actually solve, or at least tell us how to solve the problem at this low mass end. And the punchline here is that stellar population provides a huge input of energy and momentum into its surrounding, and perhaps this somehow drives the gas out from the galaxy outside into the intergalactic medium and lowers the galaxy masses. So let's see how that can work in practice. So as you heard from Phil, we have this project that we call FIRE project. And in this project, we try to implement what we know about the star forming medium in galaxies, so an interstellar medium. And we try to implement physics on the scales that are matching giant molecular clouds. We cannot really resolve what's going on inside in the cosmological simulation, but we can at least try to focus on these scales that we can resolve. Typically, they're of tens of parsecs, and try to implement processes that we know must be happening. And the hope is when we implement this local feedback, perhaps that's going to couple to the larger environment and also regulate galaxy masses. And as we will see in a couple of slides, it actually does regulate galaxy masses quite nicely. And one thing that, again, we already talked about, supernovae that were the focus on a large number of feedback mechanisms over the past few decades are not the only feedback. I mean, they're very important, and they're energetically very important, and they also look kind of really nice on the images, both from the interstellar medium and from the simulations. But there is a range of relevant feedback processes that occurs as soon as the stars form, and typically well before the supernovae explode. And some of these processes are formation and heating of the H2 region, so basically ionization of the local medium, stellar winds, photoelectric heating, radiation pressure of the embedded dust in this dense medium, and finally, a couple of million years later, supernova energy and momentum that might finally completely disrupt the cloud and perhaps drive these outflows. So the medium in which supernovae explode is well pre-processed before they explode. So they don't explode in the densest pieces of the interstellar medium. They explode in the pre-processed part of the clouds where the O and B stars live. So what we do in order to try to model these all of these feedback mechanisms, we need to resolve GMC scales. And the typical densities of the giant molecular clouds are of order of 100 particles per cubic centimeter. And that's actually the threshold in which we start implementing our star formation model and our feedback model. And the typical resolution that we can reach in the fully cosmological zoom-in simulation ranges for one or few parsecs for the tiniest dwarf galaxies that we simulate, to tens of parsecs for the Milky Way-sized halos, all the way to around 50 parsecs. And energy and input we have in this energy and momentum input that we have in this simulation is based on Starburst 99 model. We don't have any parameters we are tuning. There are parameters we could change, but we don't have tunable parameters. And we don't do any hydro decoupling once the feedback is implemented, and we don't do any cooling prevention of the hot material that results from these supernova explosions at the end. So let's see what we get here. So again, this is something that was shown this morning, but without any parameter tuning for these simulations, we actually first want to compare to simplest possible observations and see how well do we do in suppression of galaxy masses. And it turns out that this model where we implement these local processes provides a very good match to the stellar mass halo mass relation. So this is the stellar mass of the galaxies in our simulations, and this is the halo mass of the galaxies. These different lines here are from abundance matching model of Beruzzi and Moster. They're a little bit different, and extrapolation at the low masses can be quite different. And these different points are individual zoom-in simulations that we actually have in this FIRE project. So we actually get really good match without any need to tune. At least at this point, we didn't try to change things. And this is actually quite impressive because you both suppress things at the Milky Way mass scales by factor of few, and you also suppress things at the dwarf mass scales by factor of hundreds or thousands. So the same model does suppression at all of these scales. And someone posed the question today that it's not enough to match only redshift zero observations, which is definitely correct. We should try to match everything that we can, and we should try to compare to observations at different kinds of redshifts. And here is the comparison, again, from the same project at redshift zero and also at redshift two. Unfortunately, data at redshift two doesn't extend to very low masses, so we have to use the extrapolation, but the part that actually overlaps is actually, again, a decent match to what the abundance matching is telling us at redshift two. So the punchline here is that this feedback on very local scales, on the star formation kind of giant molecular cloud scales, regular galaxy masses at all times that we can see, and most of the redshift range we can actually model in these simulations. Again, going back to the importance of including several different feedback mechanisms is the following plot, where we plot the stellar mass divided by the universal baryonic fraction of the halo mass as a function of the halo mass. And again, these lines are from Moster and Beruzzi models, and these individual points here with the full circle are models where we include all of the feedback mechanisms. And these other points here are points where we exclude individual mechanisms, such as supernovae or radiation pressure, or we exclude them all. So because of this nonlinear coupling between all these mechanisms, excluding one of them can actually give you very, very bad match to the galaxy mass function or to this abundance matching problem. So for example, if you turn off supernovae, you can get huge differences with the outcome. The same can happen when you turn off radiation pressure, no radiation pressure, or H2 regions. You get very huge differences with the outcome. So it's really important to include all of them because they are coupled nonlinearly, and one preprocessing enables the second feedback to actually work much more efficiently later on. So what I'm going to show next is the movie you already seen that Phil showed, but I'm going to discuss a couple of different aspects, and it's going to show the region in one of these moving zooming simulations that shows Milky Way mass halo collapsing from very high redshift to redshift zero, and it's going to be color-coded, showing different colors for the cold, warm, and the hot medium. And what you're going to see is that there is this period of extremely fast growth of the galaxy and pretty high star formation rate that's going to drive large outflows into the circumgalactic medium. And you're going to see that these outflows are pretty much episodic. They're quite bursty. And only at late times, kind of after a redshift of one or so, things slow down. The outflows are less common. And the galaxy starts building something that looks like an extended disk. So the, at least in these models, extended disk of galaxies build up quite late. And similar, it seems to be in other models discussed this morning. And what is interesting and what we're going to get back to after I show you the movie is that these strong outflows at high redshift have huge mass loading. But by the time we reach redshift zero, the outflows are much, much weaker. And we actually cannot really even detect them in some of the ways we are trying to detect outflows at tens of kiloparsecs from the galaxy. So let's just play the movie. So structure collapses basically on all scales, and tiny small galaxies form. They're growing by the accretion from intergalactic medium. They're merging with each other. And all the time, they're sending these strong outflows to the surrounding medium as, that you can see as the gas moving out. And the color scheme is magenta is cold gas, the green is warm gas, and red is hot gas. And the galaxy formation is pretty messy all the way down to redshift 2. This was like period of huge outflow from this particular galaxy. But then around redshift of 1.5 or 1, things slow down. The outflow rates, the star formation rates slow down. The outflows from the galaxies are actually much less prominent. And you start building something that looks like a disky system. Even in that time, you can occasionally have strong bursts of star formation. But in almost all of these instances at redshift 1 and below, this is triggered by the passage of the satellite that's going to trigger the burst soon after. And when there are no passages for brief periods of time, the galaxy actually is slowly accreting its outer disk and forming stars slowly. And occasionally, you see big episodes of outflows, but this is pretty rare. And the mass loading in general, it's much, much lower at the, than at the high redshift. Yeah, these initial conditions were a little bit unfortunate because we actually have significant merger of this disk galaxy at redshift 0.2 or so, which you're going to see in a second. But nevertheless, the point is that these extended disks form pretty late, and period of these strong outflows happen mostly at high redshift. At low redshift, outflows are much weaker. Yeah, I can show you details later. So what can we actually do with these simulations? Again, we heard a lot of discussion what we should do. But this opens up all kinds of interesting field because we are connecting small scales within galaxies to the scales of the circumgalactic and intergalactic medium more or less directly after you skip steps of what's going on below tens of parsec scales. So we can actually ask, because we know stars are affecting their surrounding in several different ways, what are the actual mechanisms responsible for the driving mass outside of galaxies and which mechanisms dominate in different halo masses and at different times? Because now we have multiple mechanisms that are interacting with each other, and their importance will vary with time and the mass. We can also ask how much material actually gets ejected from galaxies and how fast. So this is important for two reasons. First of all, we would like to understand if this is a good match to the reality and maybe help us interpret the observation. But the second of all, maybe we can actually use the results from this kind of simulation to help out larger scale simulations that want to model thousands of galaxies to set their wind models in a more consistent way with this kind of simulations, which is this part. What is the dominant outflow phase? Are outflows this hot material that goes very far from the galaxy, or most of the mass is in this colder pieces that are flying out of galaxies after each outflow episode? And where do these outflows actually go? We know that they must pollute intergalactic medium at least a little bit because there are metals even in Lyman Alpha forest. But typical outflow episodes, does it actually come back into galaxy or it leaves the halo? So we already heard, again, a little bit of discussion here, and I'm going to try to address this point in a second. And a related question that we would like to address, although we don't have convincing arguments yet, is if the gas is accelerated on the way out, and if it is, how it is accelerated. And the example I will show is actually saying that at least for a couple of episodes we analyze, it's not accelerated, actually decelerating. And very much a related question is feedback continuous or bursty? Can we just drive winds at all times, or they only happen when we have kind of bursts of star formation? And in most of the examples I will show, it's going to be quite bursty. And finally, one of the most interesting questions is, how do outflows actually affect the infalling material? Do they prevent the infall, at least temporarily? Do they prevent it for long periods of time? Do they mix? Do they dynamically interact with each other? And what kind of consequences that has for galaxy formation and for the circumgalactic medium? And something that we ultimately need to do and want to do is to figure out how can we use simulation to interpret current observations, and also, even more importantly, how can we use observations to constrain the physics implemented in these models to know if we are missing something and what are we actually missing. So let's try to address some of these questions and show you an example, at least for kind of middle part of this table of what we can address at this point. And we are kind of working on all of these issues simultaneously. So first thing to note is that the star formation in the simulation where you try to put feedback locally and when you have star formation that occurs only in high density gas, in low mass galaxies, it's almost always bursty in all implementations we've seen. That's true in FIRE project, that's true also in OSCAR simulations and Trujillo-Gomez and Shenzhen and all other simulations that are trying to implement both feedback and star formation the small scales at pretty high threshold densities. And this needs to be taken into account when we want to study correlations of outflows with star formation rate, because each burst can actually create a burst of outflow that flies through the halo. So you might be able to detect outflow episodes even 100 million years or so after the burst of star formation happens. So you need to be careful how you're correlating those two. And this is where Sasha's work is actually coming into place. He's trying to address exactly this question. How can we learn about mass loadings from the episodes of star formation? And what kind of mass loadings are we getting? So we kind of zoom in onto one of these plots that show this bursty star formation. And we're going to show that bursts of star formation are drawing the bursts of outflows through the halo. So in this particular plot, we show the star formation rate multiplied by 10 to get better on the scale, outflow rate, infall rate, all in solar masses per year as a function of cosmic time. And this is all at high redshift, between redshift of 4 and 2 or so, for a relatively low-mass Lyman-Bray galaxy-type halo at redshift 2. So this Wiggle black line is the star formation rate of this particular galaxy that we follow in time. These red lines are showing the outflow rates. This dashed line is measured at quarter of the virial radius. So for each burst of star formation, we can actually see the outflow that flies through quarter of the virial radius, typically tens of millions of years later. And this dotted line shows the outflow through the virial radius, 0.95 of the virial radius. So not all of the outflow episodes actually create net mass loss from the halo. Most of the outflows are crossing quarter of the virial radius, and they are either mixed in or they are coming back. And only the strongest outflow typically send reasonably large quantities of mass over the virial radius directly into the IGM. The other thing to notice is that we can also follow the infall in these simulations. Again, the dashed line is infall through the quarter of the virial radius, and dotted line is the infall through virial radius. And you see that the infall, it's also quote-unquote bursty. It's much less variable than the star formation and the outflow, but you see these episodes. And typically what happens is that large episode of outflow suppresses the infall temporarily, but then the material either comes back or the info from IGN reestablishes itself and is driving star formation again. So there is this cycle of info, star formation, and outflows that we try to study in these simulations and try to learn in detail about how the galaxies are building up and what do they do with the circumgalactic medium. So one thing that I want to point out is the difference between low and high redshift that you've seen in the movie, but it's good to show it on this diagram. So star formation, it's very bursty at high redshift, but then at the later times, these outflow episodes are actually much less common. And even though star formation rate can be few solar masses a year, there's very little mass crossing the quarter of the virial radius. So if there are outflows, they typically are either local fountains or just very big outflows. And this is big difference between high redshift and low redshift, because that's telling you if you're observing halos, a large radii, the prediction from this simulation would be that you should detect much less outflowing material at large radii than at higher redshift. And we are trying to figure out what exactly happens here, what's causing this effect. There are a couple of possibilities. We have deeper potential wells for the same feedback model. We have less concentrated star formation. The galaxies are getting larger, and also the individual clumps within galaxies are getting smaller, or maybe we are seeing galactic fountain that we cannot detect as material crossing quarter of the virial radius. So we're trying to figure out what's going on, but this is probably responsible for this nice smooth disk formation that we see below redshift 1 or so. So these are the results where we actually try to integrate these bursts of star formation and bursts of outflows. So typically, they're delayed by tens of millions of years. So what we are plotting here is the mass loading for all of our simulations that we have above redshift of 2 as a function of halo mass. And the mass loading here, again, is defined with the appropriate time delay. So if we did like one-to-one correspondence at a fixed period of time, then we would get different mass loadings, because each burst creates the outflow that happens only later in the halo. And if you want to see the mass loading at the virial radius, you would have to use different time delays. So this is appropriate for this quarter of the virial radius measurement. And this is very important because, I don't know if Crystal mentioned it today, but I've seen some results from before. You can see highly star-forming galaxies, one that shows huge amount of outflows and the other one that shows very little outflows in terms of mass loadings. And these appropriate time delays, if you're actually detecting outflow at a large radii, might explain what's going on. So for the virial radius, the delay can be typically hundreds of millions of years. So the interesting thing here is that low-mass halos are really driving very much mass-loaded winds. The mass loadings can be factors of tens, or in the extreme case, can be even higher. But typically, for 10 to the 10 solar mass halos, mass loadings are of order of tens. And then the more massive halos, they drop to factors of few, typically, at least at this higher redshift. We are expecting these trends to go down with redshift, but we don't have results at lower redshift. So one interesting thing related to this is whether these winds are energy or momentum driven. So we don't really have detailed analysis of what's driving the winds, but just for fun, Sasha plotted these lines of how would the energy scaling winds look like and the momentum scaling winds look like, and we just fixed them at this point. It's not a fit. But it's interesting that this, now the mass loading is plotted as a function of circular velocity of the halo. So it's interesting to see that indeed at the low masses, the scaling of the mass loading with the circular velocity of halo is much steeper than in the high masses. And it might be -2 or it might be even -3. We are not really sure. We need to analyze this in more detail. The other interesting thing is that at the high mass end, you're getting something more closer to the momentum scaling or perhaps even lower scaling. So there is something going on when these multiple feedback mechanisms reinforce each other, you get different scaling of the mass loading at the low mass end and the high mass end. And that's something that we can actually inform these larger scales models to see if we are getting consistent picture of what's needed to actually get the mass function match. So these are the numbers of how the mass loading scales with the halo mass and redshift. And again, in low mass halos, at all redshifts, you get very high mass loadings. And this is typically dropping down with the halo mass and dropping down further. And typically, it's also dropping down with redshift. The reason why we ignore this number is that it's a single megaburst that we detect for all of the halos we have. So we are planning to continue this analysis down to redshift 0 and have a full range of mass loadings as a function of halo mass and redshift for all of our simulations, and try to see if we can understand what's going on in the observations based on our results. One thing to mention also is that the winds are multi-phase, so there are several different phases in this outflowing material. And the dominant phase, at least in this simulation, is the cold phase. And by cold, here we are just crudely separating phases into stuff that is flying out with a temperature higher than 100,000 degrees or lower than 100,000 degrees. So this diagram shows the total mass expelled through shell integrated between redshift 4.5 and 2 for this halo mass. And we just integrated all of the burst episodes and see how much mass is crossing certain shell at 0.2, 0.3, or 1 virial radius. And then we split this total mass into hot component marked with red and the cold component marked with blue. So basically, for this particular halo at all radii, the dominant component is this colder material. The hot component seems to be only typically tens of percents of the total outflow, or even 10%, depends where you measure it. And the second important thing is that the amount of stuff that actually leaves the video radius is only a small fraction of the total. In this particular case, it's 30%, but in many cases, it's even lower. So you have huge mass loadings in the center, but the stuff is not really leaving the halo. It's either mixing in or it's recycling back onto the galaxy. And the consequence of this is the stuff that Phil's student, Elena Murchikova, is working on, is that the baryonic fractions within halos are pretty high. So you should concentrate on these green points here. So for all of the halo masses, especially about 10 to the 10, we are getting kind of 50, 60, 70% of baryonic fractions within halos. So the winds are flying out of galaxies. They are regulating the mass, but only a fraction of them is leaving the video radius. So we can also try to do observational tests of the winds, and this is the work that Claude André is doing. And the role of winds in trying to figure out what's going on with the circumgalactic medium, it's twofold. First of all, the winds themselves can represent halo absorbers. And the second of all, they're actually spreading the infall region to larger, physically larger regions that can also increase the presence of the halo absorbers. So this particular test shows the covering factor of the Lyman limit systems in these simulations, showing these different symbols over here, as a function of halo mass, and we compare it to the results from Rudy et al. And we are getting actually quite a good match to the observations that have pretty large uncertainty at this point. But the point here is that if we have models without outflows that show only infall region, the corresponding covering factors would be only of 10 or 15% or so. So we're increasing covering factor of the Lyman limit systems by a factor of few by having these winds. The second thing goes back to this burstiness is that the winds themselves are actually variable. So if you want to measure your covering factor, you need to take your galaxy at several different snapshots, or you need to have a huge number of halos or galaxies, because your covering factor will vary for the same system over tens of millions of years of time scales. And finally, the last thing I wanted to mention are wind kinematics. So we only have preliminary results for this, but it's kind of interesting to show you what's going on. So we're just going to focus on one or two bursts that are occurring in one of our galaxies at redshift 2 and see interesting consequences for the kinematics of the outflowing and inflowing material. So this is the plot showing net mass flow rate, either infalling with negative velocity or outflowing with positive velocities here. And for observers, just remember to switch these plots. Negative is infall in our case, and positive is outflows. And we're going to start this analysis at the time when the infall completely dominates of what's going on in the CGM. And we can actually follow this infall at the inner radius, 0.2 virial radii, at the middle of the halo, 0.5, and at the virial radius. So in this particular case, the infall of the material into the galaxy is actually accelerating on the way in. So let's just see how this is going on. So a little bit later, this infall fuels star formation, and that starts driving some sort of outflow. So the interesting thing is that infall and outflow coexist within halo. You cannot separate them. So infall and outflows are always mixed in within halos. They might have different geometries, but punchline is that CGM is this very complex multi-phase dynamical system, and we need to take it into account when we are analyzing these simulations. So let's just continue following these outflow episodes. So this was just a small burst that basically died away, but at this point you see something interesting. So some really fast moving material, it's crossing our inner shell. So that's a sign that something sent this really fast gas from the center of the galaxy, and you're going to see the consequence in a second. So that particular burst is actually creating huge outflow that is crossing our inner shell. And again, one thing that we can notice from here is that the outflow itself, it's typically several times the sigma 1d that we show here, or several times vc of the galaxy, while infall is always around sigma 1d or vc of the galaxy. So outflows are always faster, and that's the reason it's much easier to actually detect them. So now we can follow these outflow episodes as they're crossing this middle radius, and then the velocity of the stuff that crosses middle radius is slowing down. And we can see a little bit later that there will be a little bit of the material crossing the virial radius. So one other thing is that the strong outflow episodes are temporarily suppressing the infall. So you can actually decouple the infall from the galaxy, at least temporarily, but it typically is going to establish itself after a few hundred million years. So now at this point, the infall is back. So these are just preliminary results, and we are trying to figure out how to characterize them and get these results as a function of halo mass and redshift. But let me just show you a few more things about the outflow kinematics. So we always have this infall star formation outflow cycle. Infall is always slower than the outflow, so it's not easy to detect it. But outflows are typically pretty fast. There are several times sigma 1d, or maybe 2 times vc or so, at least at this quarter of the virial radius. They might be faster or very close to galaxy, which is broadly consistent with the observations. And this particular example, where we actually follow only outflowing material, is showing that some outflows can be actually really fast. If you pay attention to this part, this is sigma 1d, some of the outflowing material can go actually to 10 times higher velocities than the characteristic velocity of that halo. So most prominent outflows reach very high velocity. The final point I wanted to make is that this is a complex time evolution, and you just cannot take situation at one single snapshot, because for this particular snapshot, you would conclude that the wind is accelerating. It was slower in the middle than it was at the outskirts. But that's just a consequence of the wind moving through the halo. So the fastest material will actually cross these shells the first thing. So the fastest material we can detect for this birds episode was actually in the inner shell. But if you take a snapshot at a fixed period of time, you might actually conclude that winds are accelerating. So one needs to be a little bit careful when we are interpreting these observations. So my time ran out, so I'm just going to leave these conclusions, and actually I'm going to read them slowly to you, and then we can move to questions. So we find that these simulations with more detailed physics implementation produce these multi-phase winds. We also find that winds successfully regulate galaxy growth by expelling these huge quantities of material from the galaxies, but they expel much less from halos. Lots of this material actually stays within CGM. The flux of material in this kind of simulation is dominated by the cold component. And we have seen that it has a large velocity range, and that seems to be varying with episodes and other properties, but typically it's few times characteristic velocity of the galaxy. And going back to the point that small fraction of the material escaped from the halo just reinforces this notion that the recycling of the wind material into the galaxies is very important, and we need to think about this issue when we're analyzing simulations and also observations. So thank you.
Thank you, Dusan. We have a lot of questions, so let me start here.
Hi. So I have a question related to this idea of wind material being recycled. As you said at the beginning of your talk, around redshift 1, it seems that star formation and the associated strong feedback kind of stops. As you said, wind material will be recycled and probably fall back onto the disk again. But it doesn't seem to be the case at low redshift. So do you have an idea of what's happening here?
Yeah, so that's what I put lots of questions, because we don't really know what's going on there. So one thing that we do in these plots is that we define outflow as something that it's faster than sigma 1d for the plot I show. So it's possible that some of the slower material is crossing it, but I would say that's unlikely. The other thing is that we have a shell where when we are analyzing winds at quarter of the virial radius. So for a low redshift, that can be actually, 60 kiloparsecs or so. So it's still possible that there are these things at much, much smaller radii, and we need to analyze to figure out what exactly is going on. So the funny thing is that infall is kind of dying down as well. So basically, whatever was in the disk is just slowly fueling the star formation. But I would say that interpretation for later. So.
Yeah. So we've heard that the feedback mechanisms are non-linearly coupled and seem to provide more of an effect than their sum. Can you explain the coupling?
So I don't know in detail exactly how things are coupled, but I can give you one example. For example, if you are exploding supernovae in this very dense medium of 100 or maybe 1,000 particles per cc, they're just not going to do any damage, because their cooling radius will be tiny and things will actually cool out pretty quickly. But if you pre-process this medium with all these mechanisms, it might need some of these mechanisms. First of all, radiation pressure is pushing the stuff around. H2 regions are creating warm material that will then expand. So all of them are pre-processing this medium. And then when you explode supernovae in that medium, they might actually couple more easily to this more diffuse material and drive outflows. But in detail, I actually don't know exactly how each coupling works.
Yeah, Kristen.
So you said the flux in this wind was dominated by the cold component. I wondered if that was true all the way down to redshift zero.
And so Sasha is working on it. We don't actually have that much results for low redshift.
I mean, specifically, I'm wondering kind of the colder stuff as you go lower in redshift, what sort of gas densities and pressures you're at, and whether this is consistent or a big problem in terms of comparison to the recent Koss-Halos results and the low densities and pressures there.
Yeah, so that we don't know the answer, but that's something we were actually discussing last week or two with Sasha, trying to figure out what exactly is going on there. But we have very little results at the low redshift. So one thing that we are also planning to do, Phil can. So by cold here, I just meant colder than 100,000 degrees. So there could be warm material in there as well, but that was just a simple distinction between this hot fluid that might be driving the wind and the cold stuff that it's encompassed on the bay and it's being pushed out. But in principle, we can slice it much better in the phases and see what's going on. And Sasha is actually planning to look something maybe more relevant for observations, looking at both down the barrel observations and studying the kinematics to actually connect those two things.
Yeah. I just want to ask a related question. That is, how do you reconcile the statement that the flux of materials dominated by the relatively cold component with the diagram you showed that suggested that the outflows were energy driven, at least at low masses?
So
doesn't this look like momentum driven?
Yeah, so this energy driven and momentum driven is just basically notion for two different scalings that it's put into simulations and semi-analytic model. In one of them, you would be driving by something that's based on energy conservation, but it doesn't mean that the energy itself is actually driving the winds. So these notions of energy or momentum scaling is just the scaling that is used in the model. We actually do not know really what's driving these things out of the galaxies and how they're being pushed.
I mean, you could measure that in your simulations. Couldn't you look at the energy flux and the momentum flux and just see how it goes with radius from the center of the galaxy, determine whether the flow really is momentum or energy driven?
Yes.
Would that be interesting to do?
Yeah, so we didn't have a chance to do it. I don't know if you did it in idealized cases.
We just measured, again, mass loading scale.
So Dushan, yeah. a kind of complementary constraint on the type of feedback or wind model that people put in a simulation is to look at the structure of the galactic disk, you know, the kinematics and the thickness at redshift zero. And I think that's an area where almost everyone, I mean, I would say everyone has some issues. I think only Forker actually brought this problem up today. So what your model does in that respect?
So we only have three halos that are kind of large, these galaxies at redshift zero, the Milky Way masses, and Freca van der Voort is actually analyzing these things. And right now it seems that it's not a problem to get the rotation curves, but it might be a little problematic to get, at least on this small sample, galaxies with very low bulk fractions, and we might have an issue with the thickness, but we don't have detailed results yet. And kind of going back to, I think, point that Volker raised, and I think Phil as well, these are three halos at the Milky Way masses, and we don't really know what they should be at the end.
Right.
So.
One more question.
Thank you. So I'm wondering about the fact that you said that at low redshift you have hardly any wind going outside of a quarter of the Vero radius. I suppose you still have accretion. Correct me if I'm wrong. So do you have some kind of a gas accumulation in this like rather small radius around the galaxy?
Yeah. So based on the movie, there seem to be gas accumulation at the larger radius. But let me actually try to show this thing. So based on this. Actually, even the gas accretion starts slowing down a little bit later, and we actually have pretty low mass accretion rate. And for this particular case, the star formation is also dying down in this case. But from the movie, we don't have, again, nice proof, but in the movie, the gas actually accretes on the outskirts of the disk. And then you need to find some mechanisms to actually bring it in and start forming stars. And it's possible that that's kind of connected to some of the signature we are seeing. So that we actually accumulate lots of material and can be cranking slowly over the giga-years time scales, but we have not checked it directly.
I propose we break here for coffee, and then we reconvene in half an hour.